Welcome to Linux Link Radio by TimeSys, the podcast for embedded Linux developers who want to simplify and speed up their custom platform development. Visit TimeSys.com today for access to our podcast archives.
Hi there. Welcome to Linux Link Radio. I'm here with Jeremiah Lott.
Hello.
Hi, and today we're going to talk about, poor man's profiling. I think what we, in the 5 minutes of planning we did for today's podcast, I think it's what we're going to call it. And Jeremiah's sitting in because Maciej is out. He is in France again. He had a training class. This was on Friday and Monday. Yeah, right.
Yeah, in the south of France.
Yes, in the south of France.
It's horrible.
So, and he is crushed that he has to be there. So I know I missed the last podcast because I was out in Boston. And so that's where I got sent. I got sent to Boston, and then Maciej gets to go to the south of France. So. How it works. But on my way back, so get this. So on my way back, this eventually leads to an embedded Linux story. Okay. I promise. Maybe. So anyway, so on my way back, so I went and, my kids are, hey, whatever. And the, of course, it's Pittsburgh, right? So it's like, it doesn't snow, but we get like crappy, sleety stuff. So if you take the car to the car wash, right? So, okay. Because that in itself is its own form of entertainment.
Yes.
Yeah. Anyway, so anyway, so we go there and I had this slip with this little magic number on it. So I go up to the thing and I punch my number in and it said it doesn't work. Bummer, right? And so I figure, okay, never problem. I pressed the cancel button and started feeding money into it. And all of a sudden it reboots. And so you see the Athlon AMD blah, 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 processor. I'm like, okay, running 386 target. That's pretty interesting. I wonder what OS it is. And you can see it chugging, chug, chug. And then there I see it, Windows XP. And so by this time, so the thing rebooted, I'm sitting in the car and my kids are entertained to no end. And there's, cars behind me, whatever, starting to get kind of frustrated because I'm too dumb. Right, from their perspective, I'm too dumb to operate the machine, which maybe is true. I don't know. Could be. Then of course it starts up and it says, SVC host.exe illegal exception. So
lots of people are probably familiar with that message.
Oh, yes. So those that are stuck doing, never mind. So, and I said, okay. That's an interesting message. I don't know how to fix that. So I go in and I finally get out of the car and I waved to the guy behind me who's starting to get steamed or whatever and smiling. So I go in and talk to the people on the counter and said, hey, the car wash crashed. And it took $2 off me. I would like my $2 back. And almost automatically went, oh, okay, the car machine crashed. the car washer crashed. So they go and they rip me a slip or whatever and they hand me my $2. And so then I walk back. At this point, the line of cars is starting to back up. And I walk to the guy in the front and the truck. This is where I thought, this is where I was humored. This is where I officially humored. So I walked to the guy in the truck and said, hey, the car wash machine blue screened and rebooted. And he stopped and said, oh, okay. he knew exactly what that was. And I said, let's run on Windows. And it just crashed. And it's like, oh, all right. Well, I'll just come back.
That's understandable. Yeah.
So he was just so used to the concept. And after I walked in, I know people are going to want their 2 minutes back. That's what's going to happen. So, but after I walked in the store, I thought about when I was in the store, I realized it must be a common occurrence because I told them that it crashed and they went, oh, okay. And took money off me. Oh, okay. Never a pause. Never I can't believe the car washing machine crashed or.
Right.
So, the one of the things I really was disappointed. Okay. So while this was working, a car crashed. Things blue screen to death. They cry. So I figured, okay, I'll get a picture.
Right.
And so I went fumbling around my waist with me. I said, "Where's your camera?" Because my phone, I won't get into the long stories. Broke it.
Okay. Right?
So, so I get my wife's phone out, and it's one of those Windows mobile, which by the way, for the record, she hates, but that's okay. And I was trying to take a picture. I couldn't figure out how to get the camera to work. Okay. So I'm pretty sure they were colluding. I'm sure there's some kind of Bluetooth collusion kind of thing going on there.
When it crashes, it sends out a signal, don't take my picture.
Yep. Yeah, disable all cameras within range. I'm positive. So I couldn't get a picture of it. And I was really disappointed because I would have loved to get a picture of the machine crashing. Right. And, so it brought to mind that for my, for here, we're in downtown Pittsburgh. And there's also there's a culinary school.
Okay.
And they have the same effect. If you go by, you've seen it.
I have seen it. I've walked by and either just had it be just a regular Windows desktop, but I've seen it blue screened or with some kind of weird DLL error message up on it. you know, just right there in their front window at ground level storefront. It's been nice.
Yeah. And that's the other thing too, is it's, you know, if I were smart enough, I would, but I guess what I'm doing is we'll start a campaign. If you guys can send me in pictures of your blue screens of death from various locations, we'll post them up there on the website, because it has to be a common occurrence, right? It just has to be. I mean, you know how reliable the software is, right? obviously. And then it dawned on me that the guy behind me in the truck was just okay.
Right.
He must have also had his Mac machine crash, his whatever crash. So I think there's a lot of opportunity. So I guess I will figure out how to work my camera phone. I'll figure out eventually. But if, you know, I know we have a lot of listeners, and if you're out there and you see a crashed Windows device, ATM, credit card machine, something, send us a picture and we'll get it up there on our website. I'm sure we should have no problem exceeding our storage limit and bandwidth limit for those in short order. And then the other thing too is, I promise, of course, Sarah, I don't know if you have one of those cool whatever phones that you can get a picture with, but if when you're walking by there one day, you can see if you can get that picture.
I can say I don't tend to walk that way, but if I'm by there, I'll keep an eye out.
Yeah, one time, and I said, we'll actually get onto the point of the podcast, I promise. Let's see, people went there 6 minutes. 6 minutes back now, but the other thing is that a couple times I crashed during their fall break or their spring break or their something break. It stayed that way for like weeks. They'd have a blue screen on there, and it would stay for, I don't know, a week and a half before someone got by and, you know, rebooted the Windows box.
Right.
And so I know there's plenty of opportunity. I put it that way. There's plenty of opportunity out there, and I'm sure. People have better luck with their telephones than me. It doesn't have to be the highest quality, as long as we can see the blue screen of death, or, you know, SVC host.exe could not run, which I know what that's all about. Send them in and we'll post them. Hey, so on to the actual topic. So we wouldn't talk about poor man's profiling. I should actually talk in the microphone, right? So we're going to talk about poor man's profiling. And I know the last time you and I, were you here when I did the thing about the profiling and OProfile and all those things?
Yeah, we did. We did like a kind of overview of user space profiling, yeah, if I remember right, or something along those lines.
Yeah. So we got feedback, and for people to say, "Hey, that's pretty interesting. That's pretty nice, but there's no way I can get that to run on my processor. I don't have the overhead to do it. It's too much work for me. I just, for whatever reason, I just, you know, is there anything that's simpler for my embedded target? There's not a lot of things I can do to check for profiling."
Okay.
And so one of the things I want to talk about is the wonder of the time command. And I know USR time is fairly well implemented in BusyVox. And even the actual time program, if you statically compile it, it's still, you know, small.
Right.
Even if you have to use a glibc kind of thing, it's still actually really small. And there's a lot of mileage you can get out of time. And, you know, when you run your program, you just run, you know, time, whatever set of parameters you want to send to time. I'll talk about that for a second. Yep. And then name your program with all the parameters, and it'll do its thing and it'll run. I know usually when that runs, you get to see there's three things. It's like user time, and there's like some basic, you know, how long did things take time pops up.
Yeah, I think it measures the real time and CPU time, and a third, I don't remember the other third one is by default. So, yeah, you know, how much time it actually spent executing, how much actual time has elapsed, which can vary depending on what else is running, obviously.
Yeah.
I remember if the other one is like time spent in the kernel or something along those lines. Yeah. I don't remember what it was, though.
Yeah. But that's just the tip of the iceberg, though, because what you can pass into that, you can do dash F and put, you know, put in double quotes, you can put a format string. I think you can use, we'll get into the form, but you could just, you know, have regular text and do /T and /newline, you know, tab and newline.
Right.
So you can, like, some minimal formatting. And then the number of things you can actually print out are fantastic. Like, you can get, go about the things that are actual troublemakers, right? So the first thing you do is you can have it run elapsed seconds. So it'll tell you how long the thing ran.
Right.
Which is not the system time or the CPU time, right? It was just right, how long the thing ran. And then you can start picking out things that are interesting, like the percent of the CPU used, you know, over the run, which I think time prints out. I think that's the last thing time prints out.
Is that
out,
a percent?
Right? No.
I don't think it prints a percent. By
maybe
default.
I should have run the man page. What do you think before? Maybe. That would interfere with our 5 minutes of prep time, right? But you could, I mean, there's other things you can actually fetch, like the major minor page faults. And those are really interesting. Major page faults are whenever the system page faults and it has to go out the disk.
Right.
And that's a big time sink. Whenever it has to go out the disk and fetch things around. So for some embedded systems, that doesn't make a lot of difference because there's no disk, right?
And no swap file.
There's no swap, no anything like that. But some folks are out there. I mean, they will have systems that run swap on them. That is a huge, I know it's a big real-time hit because it's non-deterministic.
Sure.
But it's also a performance hit too when it has to go out the disk because you get interrupted and that'll generate what's called a non-voluntary schedule yield as well. So you might get scheduled out for your IO call.
Right.
And at the same time, the other class of page faults are the minor ones, and minor page faults are page faults without IO access. So you can print those, out. I think, F is the, capital F. So anyway, I'm sorry, I get off because I get all excited, but there's a bunch of format specifiers in that text string. So you could put percent and then some number. Best thing to do is just go get a man of time and right. See what's there. We'll talk about the interesting. It's like capital F I know is major page faults. And then uppercase R is the minor page faults. So okay. Those are the page faults that don't require any kind of access to disk.
Okay.
So it's just like shuffling data around. It's doing right. Some bookkeeping operations more than IO operations.
Sure, yeah.
And those are really interesting to see because they can really have an effect on the performance of your system. The other thing, when you get into tracking what happens is things like voluntary and involuntary context switches. So when you do a voluntary context switch, that's whenever you do a syscall or a schedule yield everything always defers to a schedule yield, but you do some sort of some sort of event that results in a scheduling yield. And then there's the involuntary swaps, and that's where you simply run out of time.
Okay.
The scheduler comes by and says, hey, you're done.
Right.
And you can really get a hold on, a handle on your application if it's doing a lot of, involuntary swaps. You can see what's happening. You're paying for that.
Right.
Because you have to pay for context switch for that voluntary swap.
Okay.
Opposed to the involuntary ones where you're just pretty much sticking in memory.
Right.
So I found that it's interesting statistic. And you can use, if you're uber slacker like me, right, you can just use the number of seconds and have it print out the number of seconds. It won't do math for you, unfortunately. So you can just say, hey, number of seconds. And then you can take a look at, how many involuntary swaps and how many, schedule yields you did and how many times you were preempted because you ran out of time.
Sure.
So if you do something that's computationally intensive, you're sitting in some great big loop and you're never really going anywhere, right?
Okay.
That's something that you would get swapped out. I'm just drawing you're making faces at me. I'm trying to make an extreme. If you did something that wrote a character out the disk.
Okay.
Constantly, right? You get two different kinds of yield characteristics.
Definitely. Definitely.
Yeah. For those processors. Probably people are going to write in, oh, you got it all wrong. It's all wrong. There's, as I said, tons of mileage out of that command. And the implementation is halfway decent on both UC libc and on the full glibc. And, to use the command, you don't really need anything else. It's not like you need any other special things in your system. That's it. And you can just read what comes out. Other handy thing is that it does pipe output to standard error.
Okay.
If you're doing something and you depend on standard in and standard out to do something meaningful, right. You won't get too, unless you really depend on standard error to do something meaningful too. But I guess if you're really hurting,
so
you could.
Time prints at the end though, right? So there's at least an opportunity to kind of separate. It prints when the process exits, right?
Yeah. Well, you know what? That's a really good point. So I guess if you did have stuff that came out of standard error that you cared about, you could put some indicators around.
Yeah, or mark the end of the program output before the time output starts.
Yeah.
Something.
So that's like a totally cool way. I mean, it's on the cheap. And you really don't need anything other than a functioning Linux system. And the nifty thing is you can model it on your desktop too to get a handle on what's going on.
Sure.
And still get the kind of input. It's not it's not as great as something like OProfile or something like that, but hey, get you there, right?
Right.
It really gets you there. And then, so the other thing I wanted to bring up was, I looked at time and I thought, oh, that's really interesting, but where's the data coming from, right?
Okay.
That's a classic question. And so Most of the data it gets, I should probably actually talk in the microphone. What do you think? So most of the data it gets is from GitR usage.
Okay.
And that's actually a standard POSIX call. I did check out. I can't remember what version of POSIX it is, but that's actually a POSIX call. But it's one of those. It's one of those things where POSIX just says it just has to tell you the user time and the system time.
Okay.
And then after that, it's, you know, implementation.
Do you want.
Implementation, yeah. Defined.
Exactly.
What is it? It's like POSIX 2001 or something. So the cool thing is that Linux meets it by telling you the user time and the system time. It puts them in like a time vowel.
Okay.
You know, you get that structure with the number of seconds,
yes. Whatever,
but type of. But then it also has things, probably just about everything that you see inside of time is in this structure.
Okay.
So if you wanted to, you could emulate time by, you know, at the end of your program, calling GitR usage and printing out the same thing.
Sure.
And that's something, if you put a debug flag or something around, you could put on your embedded system and not really require even the time program.
But you don't need time program since it's just a syscall and printf, which you probably
have there. Yeah, or you could syslog it, right? If you're running the syslogger, right?
Sure.
So you could get that one bit out of your program, and I'm sure with probably 15 or 20 minutes of programming, you could probably do the extra little bits. You could pass it an arbitrary string as an environment variable and something along those lines to do some basic formatting to get different data out if you wanted to.
If you wanted to. I mean, I guess I'm a more, you know, I probably just print everything and use the computer part or the human parser.
Yeah, yeah,
you
know, yeah.
Me reading it at the end to figure out what's what. But
so sometimes you're into it that, you know,
yeah.
Sometimes you roll that way. So it's, it does depend. But I mean, the cool thing about GitR usage is that you don't have to print it out at the end, because the other thing that's I would say a flaw about time, the program time, is that you have to start the program using time,
right?
And you got to wait till it ends, and then of course if you hit Control C or whatever else, it'll still.
Right. Yeah. But you're right. Most of the time when I've used time, what I actually end up doing is writing a special test program that uses a function or something that I want to time two different implementations or something, compare the results, but end up writing something special just to run under time, you know. Yeah, I mean, obviously it depends a lot on what you're writing, but if you're writing something that runs for a significant amount of time or, you know, combines a lot of factors, it can be hard to get an isolated result.
Yeah. Yeah, I know exactly what you mean. And so the other little thing about our GitR use is you can call it at any time the program's running, and it'll just tell you the number. Just come back and say, hey, here's a number for now, right? This is the instantaneous sampling of this, which is actually pretty darn cool, because then you can have your program print that out at, you know, arbitrary times.
Okay. Right?
Arbitrary. So you could have, you know, if you go the super poor man way, we'll start the easiest way, right? So you could just have it print out at certain critical intervals. You could have it print out whatever statistics you wanted right to the console or to standard error.
Okay.
But that may not be what you're looking for, right? So the other suggestion is to hook that up to a signal, right?
Okay, yeah.
And whenever you pass a signal in, whenever you raise a signal, and, you know, you raise a signal with kill, right? You can say kill, which is, I always found that troubling that you raise a signal through kill, right?
Right.
But in essence, you can run kill and then raise a signal with kill and like hook up sig user or whatever.
Right.
And then have it and use that to dump out the signal in order to dump out the sampling. Of course, it'll screw things up a little bit, right? So if you're counting signals,
yeah, right,
you'll be off by one.
And it takes time to do that, so that, you know, that'll be included in your next time call or whatever, or even in the previous one, the time up until you call. Get our usage. It'll be all recorded in there. But you know, that's a great debugging trick in general, is to make a debug. You know, use an otherwise unused signal to. Trigger debug output. You can do things like GitR usage, or there are other, you know, kind of interesting data you can get from the kernel about the currently running process. And of course, you could just dump data from your own program out at that time too. You know, state of global variables.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know,
I guess
the whole thing, right? So
I was looking at my notes there, and you're right. I should have talked. Yeah, because you can print anything you. Darn well wanted to, yeah.
Right. I mean, that you know, I know we're talking about generally profiling, but I assume a lot of people are already using that trick. So But if you're not, that's a great trick in general for lots of different types of debugging and profiling. And GitHub usage is a good kind of addition to the data you would print.
Yeah, no, that's a really good point.
Yeah.
It's definitely on the cheap. And what's nifty about that is, you know, if you print out the standard error, you're really not using anything else out of the system other than what's already there. You're only adding a burden. You're adding a little some code, right? And I guess at the same time, you're probably adding in a context switch and some other little Heisen effects to the program. But if you look at what's involved in order to get that to work, it's so minor. Unless you're very timing dependent, you could probably not live with having those problems. Or you could probably live with those problems.
For many applications, a majority of applications, I would guess, that would be true.
Yeah. Yeah. And then the other, like, you know, cheapo way of looking at what's going on is you can just look right at, of course, it gives you much less information, right? But you can also just scan out the proc file system. So under proc, there is a directory, right, for every process, for every PID. So,
yes.
You know, same thing. You have to go in, see what your PID is, and then look in there, and you'll be able to see the some information about your process.
Although, you know, it doesn't work for children, but if you want to query about you, I'm pretty sure that proc self is essentially a link to the current processes area in proc. So you could do proc number, which would be your PID. But if you just want to know about you, you can generally say proc self and then the same thing and put self instead of number there. So it's not that useful when you're doing what a lot of people do with proc, is where you run it in one shell and you have another shell open.
Yeah.
You know, obviously self will be the shell.
Will be the shell, yeah.
Right. But if you're doing something
That would take me like an afternoon to figure out.
Yeah, but if you're doing it in the handler.
Sorry about that.
If you're doing it in the handler like that and you're accessing the current process, you should be able to just say proc self and not have to worry about getting the PID and going back.
That's a good point.
But there's a lot of interesting data in there. I mean, one thing that comes to mind right off the bat is, you know, your open file handles are shown there.
Oh, yes.
So, one, you can see whether you're leaking them, but in general, you can see what's going on with those. And there's a bunch of information in there about, you know, the current kind of state of memory, what's mapped where.
Yeah.
That can be useful if you're debugging the program at that level.
Yeah. You can get a lot of mileage out of something simple like that. And the cool thing is that on an embedded system, right, it requires CAT, right, CD and CAT, in order for you to see what's going on there manually.
And it really only requires CAT if you're going to do it from the command line, right? I mean, you just open up those files and read them, right? I mean.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, I agree.
Yeah.
I'm so lazy, I can't remember by dead reckoning the name, so I have to fish around.
No, yeah, but I mean, if you're doing it in a program, obviously all you have to do is just call open, pass the path in there, and read, and do whatever you want with the data that comes back.
Yeah. You could probably also hook that up to your interrupt handler too, right?
Yeah, definitely. You could put it right there in the signal handler, the debug signal handler, and just open up, you know, various things in proc and print them out. One of the things we're talking about during our prep is, you know, you can print them on standard error, but if you've got syslog running or something along those lines, you could also print a series of them syslog, or you could open a file or something in a known location.
Yeah.
So you can kind of get a timeline of, you know, when I did it, you know, while it's running, send the signal
at
various times, and then get a timeline of at this time it was this, at this time it was that, at this time it was that.
You know what people do with syslog too, because I know the BusyBox syslog does this, is they'll do syslog and they'll set up to do remote syslogging.
Okay.
And so they'll run syslogd and they'll allow connections, right? And then they'll have another host. You know, the IP of the machine they're debugging, and they'll have another host hook up and get the syslog data for that.
Sure.
So it's not even like you need to be sitting on the tube. I mean, you can have that run and have another machine that does the collection.
Right.
Because depending upon the machine, people put the syslog out there in some kind of RAM disk. And if you're doing like an endurance test or something, we're going to generate a lot. Right.
You could fill up memory. Yeah.
Yeah.
You might be a problem.
Yeah. You can get into problems that way. And so that way you can have that logged remotely. It may even work for the field. I don't know that people that do that in the field, sometimes, but but definitely on the bench. I mean, that's a real common strategy that I see. It's got me out of a couple scrapes too. I'll put it that way. I won't even get into how I got into it, but you know, it's a great way for you to figure out what's going on. If you do, you have something that's right before a crash or doesn't quite ever make it out, or you screwed up your console. You know, anything along those lines, you can use syslog and then syslog over the network to make your life a little bit easier. But again, you'll pay the interrupt tax, and you'll pay some other overhead in order to do that. But still, not so bad overall. And then I guess the last thing in the talk about it. So this is interesting. This is like user land stuff.
Okay.
But you also have kernel. And the in terms of kernel, poor man, sort of, I should say, profiling, debugging, whatever else is DebugFS.
Okay.
Which is pretty darn cool. Most kernels, actually, if you do a cat, you know, /proc/filesystems, a lot of kernels will have DebugFS, enabled, right? So the first thing is, for any of these, you have to, if on an embedded system, or you have to have procfs.
Okay.
Or, pardon me, DebugFS is a file system in the kernel, right? So there's a little bit of overhead there. Then inside the kernel, or inside the kernel module you're running, you define directories and some files. And the file types you can have are things like Booleans or integers, or just a text area, blob data. And whenever you define them, you say, okay, you know, I've defined this memory. I've defined this file name that should appear in this directory structure in my DebugFS.
Okay.
And whenever I do a read on that, it should go get the memory located at this pointer that's n many bytes long.
Interesting.
And deposit it out, and send it over when the user does the read. So you can be along, sitting there and just do cat and print out a file stop and go out to that chunk of memory and out comes the data. And it's really the slacker way of getting a picture of what's going on inside of your kernel module. And I think it's one of those really nifty, but otherwise not unused, but not used as much as it could be, kind of file systems.
So basically, you end up mapping a memory area in from kernel space from your module or whatever piece of kernel code that you're writing, and when you read the file from user space, you get that same
block of memory
kind of on demand.
Yep.
There's no requirement for me and my module to copy data to a particular location for it to be available, or is it?
Well, the thing is, you pass it in, it has some wrapper function. So there's wrapper function to say, okay, this is a wrapper function for an integer. So whenever I'm read, I'll return the integer at this memory location.
Right, but I would just point that right to the variable in my code that I'm interested in.
Exactly.
So as it changes.
Yep. And there's no C. Yeah. And there's no like, I mean, if you want to guard, if you have a couple threads that are running, synchronization, your problem, right? So there's nothing to keep the data synchronized.
Okay.
But then again, it's a really nifty way to come by, stop by and scrape that. If you do like a mount, you can say /proc/filesystems, and on a lot of kernels there's a USB DebugFS. Tree.
Okay.
And you can see what's going on in the USB system.
Interesting.
And I forget what I saw for another one that's there by default. And, it's the same thing. When you crank up your module, there's some registers and unregisters, there's a tuple that say, hey, I'm going to register these. And then when you do your unload, you should unregister them. And I guess I never experimented to see what would happen if you didn't unregister them, but my feeling it would be bad, right?
But yeah, I like a lot of things, I assume that if your module is just loaded and stays loaded all the time, it's probably not the end of the world.
Yeah.
But it would be bad if you're constantly being loaded, unloaded.
Yeah. I didn't experiment.
Who knows, though?
With that.
I don't know.
But then if you just compile directly into the kernel, well, you don't have to worry about the unload part.
Right.
So on mod load, you just register your devices, and that's it. It just sort of does its thing and works along. And that's it's just the greatest way to do some, really simple debugging. And that's, they said, there's, you should load up. You'll definitely see a tree for USB. And if you want multiple directories, you just say, hey, define a directory. And then when you put, you pass in a, it comes back and gives you some IDs, right?
Right.
Yeah. So you get a handle that says, hey, this is the directory that you created. You're going to create a file in that directory. You pass in that handle and there it is. It's like magic.
I wonder if I can pass it pointers to things that I didn't define, like other parts of the kernel I'm interested in.
Well, it's all flat memory space, right?
Yeah, you should be able to. I can't see why you wouldn't be able to.
Yes, yeah, it's totally unprotected. I mean, yeah. that's the whole thrill of doing... right? That's the, yeah, well. That's the thrill of kernel, kernel development is that it's flat memory space and there's no protection or anything. You just go crazy.
Right, so you could print out stuff from the subsystem you're using or anything that... If you understand the internals of it enough to actually be interested in what its values are, but
I know formally, I mean the part you can use for text files comes out and it says, hey, it's a blob. You can just format that as text, right? You just put some text in there and you're off to the races. And I said on the target system, all it really requires is cat and then, you know, debug FS. You can compile it into your kernel. Oh, you know, I know what I want. I made a little note of myself, but the other thing you can do is you can set up a kernel module parameter. Right.
Okay.
You know, you don't have to pay. You'll pay a little bit, right? It's always gets down to that you can have flexibility in code size, right? So, you know, the more options you, right, the more coding it takes. But, you know, for not that many kilobytes, you could code in a flag that you pass in your module, right? And then when your module loads, it
either registers or doesn't register.
Either registers or doesn't register. And that way you can leave the code sitting around there. Or if you wanted to, you could tickle your module in such a way that it registers all the nodes and unregisters them. It's
It might be an interesting. I wonder how much overhead there is from having those. Having the registration.
Well, really, I mean, it goes out there. I actually trace through the code. It just creates an inode, right? So it's not.
I would imagine it's relatively small, but probably obviously not non-existent.
Yeah. Well, there's always overhead, right?
Right. Little impact, I would think, on performance other than the load time it takes to register them initially. But probably, it's going to increase your footprint in a small way because it's got to store those registrations somewhere, obviously.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah. That's my little like poor man's overview of what you could do for debugging profiling if you don't have, a full system. I'm sure there's, 50 things that I missed, but you should always feel free to send in any comments or questions if you have them, what you do for debugging or profiling. I'd love to hear them because for all these things, necessity is the mother of invention, right? So as you're stuck with, you find out that you only have three commands to to use, you figure out really quick what to do in order to get things set up properly.
Right.
So that's what I wanted to cover today. I hope I didn't forget anything too major. I bet you I did.
I don't think so. That's everything I remember prepping, so.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
You have really good memory. It's like,
well, it was like half an hour ago. But I'll never know, right? Yeah. It was just between Gene and I for the prep, so.
So if you have any comments or questions or suggestions, send them in to podcast@timesys.com. Believe it or not, we read. We get a lot of email, and we read them all in reply. Feel free. Love to hear what you're working on. And different kind of debugging techniques. And we're more than happy to share them, post them out there. We'll do a better job of posting out some of our comments, I think. And, if you have your crash pictures, your Windows crash picture, send it on in. I want to get that gallery up and going because I'm sure there's lots of them, right?
Yeah, that'd be great if we, I'd like to see that too.
You can send those to, podcast@timesys.com. That would be great. And thanks a lot. And then I think Maciej's back from the, I'm working. I think he's back next week, but then we're going to ESC.
Okay.
And so I don't know exactly how. So we finally talked the marketing people into letting us put a Linux and radio thing at our booth at ESC because we'll be at ESC the week of the 13th or 14th or whatever. So company will be there, and we'll have our little Linux and radio equipment and our microphones and whatever else. We'll see if we can get some people to. I think after we interview people at the show in Toronto. I don't think we'll ever get anyone to interview with us ever again. I'm fairly sure of it. But yeah, so if you're heading out to ESC, we'll catch you there. You can stop by the TimeSys booth. We'll get you something. I think they're handing out some sort of tchotchke. I just hope it isn't. I hope it's nice. But yeah, so stop by and we're going to see if we can get some interviews in. And we'd love to hear about the project you're working on. And if you have time and we can get you interviewed for something for Linux Link Radio, that'd be great. Are you heading out there much, or you get to stay home?
Jeremiah, but yeah. Yes, no.
Oh, my goodness. just for the record, there's a little sign here on his microphone that says Mache, so never mind.
Yeah, well, I will not be there. I'll be here.
I can get my kid's name straight either. So
slaving away, but there'll be some guys from my colleagues from engineering are going to be there. I don't know if they're going to be at the booth or if they're just there for sessions. But
yeah. What's my second link? So get this. So next week, I get to go to Nagano Province in Japan. And then, okay, so this is the brilliant scheduling we have here. So right, Nagano ski, I'm in the Japanese Alps. No time to ski. They're like, oh, you have to be here and set up our booth and the marketing people. We got things for you to do. So I have to be booth labor. And so I don't even have a day to ski. And I have to fly back on Sunday.
That's kind of sad. You got to get the Mache deal.
Mache calls. You hear the seagulls in the background and everything else. Like, oh, I'm working hard. He's not. He's not. I know how that works. Anyway, well, said thanks a lot. And said any questions, comments, send them to us at podcast@timesys.com. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, bye, everyone.
This podcast was brought to you by TimeSys. Are you new to embedded Linux? Looking for a way to simplify your next project? The Linux Link service by TimeSys makes it easy to build your custom embedded Linux platform. Go to timesys.com today or call 866-392-4897 to learn more.